Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Hey, Sound Opinions listeners, if you support us on Patreon, you get to listen to our podcast ad-free on Patreon. You're listening to Sound Opinions, and this week we're talking with director Mary Harron. We'll chat about how she's expertly used music in her films, including American Psycho, Charlie Says, and the new Dolly Land. I'm Jim DeRogatis.
And I'm Greg Kot. We'll also talk about her origins as a punk rock journalist. But first, a review of new music from The National.
And the last thing you wanted is the first thing I do. I tell you my problems, you tell me the truth. It's the last thing you wanted, it's the first thing I do. I tell you that I think I'm falling in love with you.
That is a little bit of The Alcott, a track from the new album by The National, First Two Pages of Frankenstein. I do love that title. And Greg, I'd be remiss, the Swifties would be on me in a second if I didn't note that The Alcott is a track featuring Taylor Swift. Yes, Taylor Swift, lending her talents along with Phoebe Bridgers and Sufjan Stevens to The National on album number 9. This group came together in 1999, first put themselves really on the map in the early 2000s as part of that Brooklyn scene, included the Strokes and the Walkmen and the Yeah Yeah Yeahs, and they have been giving us very interesting collections of alt-country, chamber pop, Americana, heartland rock, singer-songwriter, sophistication ever since. Lead singer, lead vocalist Matt Berenger, two sets of brothers key to this band, the Desners and the Devendorfs. Like all of us, they were waylaid by the pandemic. And, you know, they've been fighting throughout their whole careers. They have conflicts here and there. A lot of pressure for solo projects. Aaron Dessner produced two albums by Taylor Swift and been working with Bon Iver in a side project called Big Red Machine. One of the other brothers has been doing soundtrack music. Got a solo album in between from Matt Berenger. Then they came back together in upstate New York at one of the brothers' recording studios to give us this new album. Did I mention I love that title? First Two Pages of Frankenstein is the name of the album. We're going to play a track here. It's called Eucalyptus. We'll come back and give our reviews in a second. This is The National.
What about the last of the good ones? What about the ceiling fans? What if we move back to New York?
take it. You should take it. I'm only gonna break it. You should take it, 'cause I'm not gonna take it. You should take it. You should take it.
That's The National with Eucalyptus. First two pages of Frankenstein is the name of the album. Apparently, he read the first two pages of Mary Shelley's novel for inspiration, because he was in a massive period of writer's block combined with depression and Matt Berninger. We wouldn't expect anything less from Matt Berninger. He has the reputation as the literate, sad dad of indie rock, and you know, why not continue it? This band is always breaking up. They're always writing about breakups. They're the band of, you know, it is constantly a theme throughout. The internal struggles of the band. Are they together? Are they not? Will they make another album? I have to say, the 2019 album they made, the previous one, I Am Easy to Find, indicated that things were not going well. There were a lot of guest stars on that record. There's a few guest stars on this album.
Yeah,
there,
as
probably
I said,
the biggest guest star in the world, Taylor Swift,
and Phoebe Bridgers.
As well,
no slouch.
As Phoebe Bridgers, who was also pretty major. I have to say, I remember pitching this band to Rolling Stone. I was writing reviews for them, and I said, "You got to write about this band." They had not heard of The National. This is back in 2003. Their album "Sad Songs for Dirty Lovers." And I loved the band for a good long stretch of time. I thought the thing that I loved about Berninger was there was sort of this understatement there, but you could tell just beneath the surface, things were not going well, and eventually it was going to erupt.
Well, and it's this,
and that would happen.
There's
you know?
This fine line and confusion. Are we talking about the breakup of the band or best friends, or are we talking about romantic relationships?
Absolutely.
Ending?
It was unclear, but at the same time, it was very visceral. And the other thing that I loved about the band, in addition to Berninger's ability to just sort of like snap, was the drumming of Brian Debendorf. I think he is one of the great drummers of the last 20 years, extremely underrated.
Did you hear what he was doing on Eucalyptus, that track we played? I just love that.
Just another voice in the band, almost like. It's another vocal. You know, it's almost answering Berninger's lead vocal
with
his drum.
I was going to talk about that, but it's so refreshing to hear you praise a drummer.
Well, over the years, he's just been great. I don't think there's enough of him on this record, and I also think I'm missing those eruptive moments.
Yeah.
That said, I feel like they've regained a little bit of their mojo. There's some really great songs on this record. Again, very understated. A lot of songs about relationships. He's almost cataloging relationships. Like, you're going to take the Afghan Whigs record. I'm
going to take the Cowboy
Junkies.
Right.
There's a lot of songs with these kind of listy things about, okay, how do we divvy up our world?
What about the rainbow eucalyptus? What about the instruments? What about the Cowboy Junkies? What about the Afghan Whigs?
We're dividing ourselves as a couple. Now we're dividing up our possessions. It's kind of sad, and it's also, I know a lot of people like that have gone through those breakups. You know, and you're talking about adult relationships. You know how rare that is?
Yes.
To have those kinds of songs out there. So I love the band for that reason. They have somehow endured. This isn't their best album.
No.
But I think it's a pretty good record.
There's a sameness that starts to drag you down after a while. There were four singles before the album came out. They were all good. Eucalyptus is just a song I love. What about the Cowboy Junkies? What about the Afghan Whigs? Like you said, you know, I think our friend of Sound Opinions, Amanda Petrusich of The New Yorker, nailed it, Greg. She has a long profile coming up, and she had a little sample on Facebook. Profile in The New Yorker of The National. That's how you know you've made it. She said, I can't think of another band that articulates the strange grief of adulthood with such elegance and candor.
Mm-hmm.
And I think she nailed it. And you said something very similar. I couldn't agree more. Yeah, a little bit of sameness after a while. Love the two Phoebe Bridgers tracks, Your Mind Is Not Your Friend, and This Isn't Helping.
But this isn't helping at all. It only makes me want to get further off. This isn't helping. This isn't helping.
Taylor Swift acquits herself well. Yeah, you know, it would be better if it was half as long or you're just enjoying the singles and Eucalyptus. But, you know, I usually do not like this vaguely Springsteenian kind of anthem rock.
Well, it's not really, there's not that many anthems, you know.
No, there's not a lot of anthems.
It's more low-key.
So I like that more here, is what I'm saying. That is what we think of the National. But as always, we want to hear from you. Share your opinions via voice message on our website at soundopinions.org. Tell us what you think of the first two pages of Frankenstein. Coming up, our conversation with director Mary Harron. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions. Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island has been brewing award-winning beers in Chicago that are inspired by this city. Take 312 Lemonade Shandy, Tropical Beer Hug Double IPA, and a rotating series of hazy IPAs only available in Chicago. You know, every time we go down to Goose Island, there's another one that they're pushing on us.
That's right.
They're all good.
Absolutely. And what supporters of musical culture, you know, in the city of Chicago and elsewhere, if you go to a show in Chicago and you see that Goose Island sign, you know you're in good hands. They're music fans as well as great beer makers at Goose Island. So we're really proud to be associated with them.
The Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer.
Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island's been brewing beers in the spirit of Chicago.
You can find IPAs, Lemonade Shandy, and limited releases in-store or at one of Goose's venues in Chicago. Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer. And we are back. This week, we have the pleasure of talking with director and screenwriter Mary Harron. Mary Harron got her start as one of us, a music journalist, Greg. Talk about humble beginnings, who wrote for and helped found a punk magazine in the 1970s.
That's right, Jim. And since then, she's shifted to directing thought-provoking films where music plays a key role. I'm talking about movies like American Psycho, I Shot Andy Warhol, Charlie Says, and her latest, Dollyland. Let's jump into the conversation.
We are thrilled to have Mary Harron as a guest on Sound Opinions. You know, Greg, the new film, Dollyland, is in the spotlight right now, but we wanted to use this as an excuse to talk about Mary's excellent use of music in all of her movies.
That's right.
And that word my students love, her journey from one of us, an ink-stained wretch, you know, writing about music and then writing about film and then making some remarkable films. Mary, thanks for doing this.
Oh, well, thank you. Nice to be here.
Why don't we start? You're in New York after growing up in Canada in the 70s, in the middle of this punk explosion, and hanging out with the folks who started Holmstrom and Legs McNeil started Punk Magazine. You're a co-founder and first journalist in America to interview the Sex Pistols. How do you go from being one of us, me and Greg writing about music, to making some great films?
You know, I moved to London when I was 13, so I'd sort of grown up half my life in London. And after the kind of CBGB's era of punk rock, I went back to London and was working as a journalist for several years, writing about music. But I feel like I should be doing something else. A lot of my friends from college had gone into documentary in Britain, which was a great period of documentary making. And so I was kind of very jealous of that. So I'd love to be in that. It took years for me to get a job there. And my first job, I got through a friend I'd worked with on Melody Maker, you know, and they were starting a pop music show that only lasted one season. And it was 1984, but it was a great, great music time, actually. You know, we had, you know, interviews with Madonna, Human League, all the pops, great pop music at that point. And I would write the questions for the interviews, which was really fun. So I would never ask about music. I would ask things like, you know, what's your greatest fear? Or what was the last dream you had? Or I asked the guy from the Human League, how much is in your bank account? You know, just kind of like really kind of out there questions. Because what people really want to know is, you know, these more personal things. And I also got to go as the researcher on different film shoots, little films that we made. And after that, I got another job, and I was another 4 years working on a documentary show. And during that time, I got the idea for my first movie, I Shot Andy Warhol. And so it was a long, slow kind of transition from journalism into documentary, which isn't such a big transition, and then into finally into feature film.
My auteurist take on Mary Harron's filmography is that you brought a little bit of that punk attitude. No separation between star and audience, right? Yeah. No worship of celebrity into many of your films. I see it in I Shot Andy Warhol, that celebrity is a double-edged sword, that it can come back and destroy what was great about someone as an artist, also destroy them as a human being. I see it in I Shot Andy Warhol. I see it in Notorious Betty Page. I see it in Charlie Says to an extent. And I see it in Dolly Land. Would you buy that or am I full of it?
Oh, no, no. I think that's really true. I learned a lot of fundamental lessons from punk that stayed with me, you know, forever. I'm not that interested in stars, which is, it's not a big thing for me, which has always been a problem for me in getting financing, because I just want to find somebody interesting to play the role. And there's always a lot of pressure on you to cast a star. But I'm also very interested in fame and celebrity and the downside of it. And I think that comes both from punk, the skepticism about that, and also having been in the music industry a bit, seeing the rise and fall of people and seeing the excitement of fame and then the downside of fame and there's always a fall of some kind.
Yeah.
And then my dad was an actor, so I sort of saw some of the ups and downs from there. But I would say the other thing that you were talking about DIY before, I really learned fundamental lesson when John Holmstrom and Legs were starting Punk Magazine, which is that you just take what you have. You just use the resources you have and in a DIY aesthetic. And I remember in the very first issue of Punk Magazine, they had to have a letters page and they had no letters. So they just used all the letters that they'd actually gotten, including one from Con Edison and one from the publisher's girlfriend complaining, about him and something else. Just anything that came to the office was the letters page. So it's like, that's a creative lesson.
Mary, it also seems like a lot of the movies are in the way that punk was devoted to outsiders and people who weren't part of the mainstream and definitely didn't fit in. Even famous people like Dolly, you know, who was clearly a weirdo and just, you know, not participating in normal life.
on his own plane, yes.
So it's a fascinating approach.
And actually, I think with Dali, you know, we're not dealing with him in the movie at the height of his... we have three flashbacks to the beginnings of his career, and then we have him at the end of his life when he's a bit forgotten. I mean, he's kind of looked down on by the art establishment. So he's at that point, he kind of, even though he's incredibly famous and wealthy, and has this kind of glamorous life, he is somewhat discarded. That was much more interesting to me than Dali at the height of his reputation.
And the other thing too that I thought was really interesting is like finding the humor in American Psycho, which like nobody saw that as humorous. Like, you know, it was like, oh my God, it's so offensive. And, you know, when I think about punk rock, the thing I remember, like now that I appreciate more than ever, is the Sex Pistols. Johnny Lydon's laughing in some of those songs. I mean, there's literally like a laughter, you know, like there's almost a comedic element that like there's a joke I'm telling. Some of you are not getting it, but people who understand are in on the joke. I don't know, it seems that sensibility is there as well, because the Dolly thing I thought had moments of incredible humor in it, and it wasn't like overt, but it definitely was an element to how you're trying to portray these people.
Yeah, I think that was always true of punk. It was always comedic, particularly American punk. I mean, the Ramones had this strong element of sort of satire in it. When they were taking like, you know, 50s rock, or it was very stylized. There was definitely sort of conscious humor in it, and the lyrics were, you know, consciously, humorously dumb. American Psycho, I read the book several years before I made the film, with no thought of making a film. I was reading it because it was so scandalous and everybody was so horrified by it. I thought, okay, I'll check this out. And from the first page, I thought, oh, no one said this was funny. this is clearly funny. Yeah. You know, yeah. Deadpan, yeah. Satirical.
And that's why it stands. I mean, I saw an interview you had done a couple of years ago talking about that film, you know, in the wake of Donald Trump bragging that he could shoot somebody in the middle of Fifth Avenue. Everybody, you know, proto Patrick Bateman, 100%.
Did you and the author see eye to eye in that, Ellis? Did he understand what you were getting at? Like, okay, it was meant to be satire or funny?
Oh, yes. Brett, clearly. Yeah. That was all, you know, the humor was not accidental. It was just, I think, buried by the shock value of the amount of sort of graphic violence.
I'm trying to listen to the new Robert Palmer tape, but Evelyn, my supposed fiancé, keeps buzzing in my ear.
Any Leibovitz. We'll get any Leibovitz. And we'll have to get someone to videotape. Patrick, we should do it.
Do what?
Get married, have a wedding.
No, I can't take the time off work.
I hate that job anyway. See why you just don't quit.
Because I want to fit in.
His work. I mean, there's always humor in everything that he does.
So the music has obviously been a big part of a lot of these films. The choice of music, I had to look up Make Me Smile. I wasn't super familiar with Steve Harley and the Cockney Rebel until I saw it in Dolly. I go, that's a really cool song.
That's a great choice, yeah.
And I thought, perfect choice. Like, it really pulled me into that scene right away.
Oh, come up and see me. Make me smile. You won't, but it won't.
Are you thinking about the music as you're sort of, you know, sketching out these scenes, or how does that work for you?
Well, a lot of the time, you know, very often you have music, you might have music in your head that's more expensive that you can't afford. So I think my husband wrote the script, you know, with me kind of, with us bashing out the story together. And we had put in like David Bowie songs, you know, or, you know, Velvet Underground, things that we couldn't afford. Sometimes your financial restrictions are a good thing, because by the time we came to make it, there'd been so much use of Bowie music that I thought, well, what about what's the lesser known glam rock, you know, of that era? And I've always loved Steve Harley and Cockney Rebel. And it was fun to kind of get Tumbling Down is a beautiful song, I think, which they play as they're leaving the hotel after this all-night party. Just sort of catches an era. In the script, we put in a Curtis Mayfield song. And there was something, as we were playing more, there was something about sort of early 70s Philadelphia soul in particular that just seemed right. And I can't say why. Originally, I would have thought a lot more disco.
Well, and Dolly Land does convey that shift from glam rock 70s, we've got a character portraying Alice Cooper, to the disco decadence, you know. We get that. You get the feel right. It's like you understand music culture.
Yes. Yeah, and Alice Cooper was, you know, proto-punk, of course. It was somebody that punks had a lot of affection for, and School's Out and I'm 18. You know, that was very much kind of like New York Ramones kind of ethos. I just remember having arrived in New York in 1975, so just a year or two later than the film is set. But I remember very much that really interesting transition in the early 70s from sort of hippie, sort of soft rock into glam. We did originally want to use Roxy Music. You know, there were things that we couldn't afford.
Well, there is one.
Oh, there's one
song,
Roxy.
Right?
There is one Roxy.
One Roxy song, and Amanda Lear is portrayed with great sensitivity and just the most fascinating character, which says a lot when you have Sir Ben Kingsley playing Dali.
Yeah.
Wow. You know, she was cover model for Roxy Music, and is in the movie, and just is it's kind of like moral core.
Yeah. Yes, I mean, Roxy being this great transition, and we were trying, you know, we were trying to get just that in this case. To be very specific to the period, because things changed so precisely 73, 74, 75, that I wanted to catch that. So try and get a right song at the right era.
Do the strand love when you feel love. It's the new age, and that's why we say do the strand.
Let's take you through your film CV. You know, you start out with I Shot Andy Warhol, which is a fascinating story. Valerie Solanas had been the radical feminist who shoots Andy Warhol. So, you know, you got to have the Velvet Underground. Mm. Casting Yola Tango as the Velvet Underground, you know, it's like perfect. How did that come to be?
We had a great music, who's now very famous, like the most famous music supervisor, Randy Poster.
We've talked to him.
One of his early films. And I think he suggested Yola Tango, and I loved them. I didn't know their music that well, and then I just, you know, fell in love with their music, and it was so perfect, and they were so Velvet's influenced. And it was great that they had a girl drummer, female drummer, like Mo Tucker. I mean, the big thing that happened with I Shot Andy Warhol is that Lou Reed would not let us use any Velvet Underground songs. So I was an old friend of John Cale, so I had asked John, because I knew he'd done a couple soundtracks like Jonathan Demme's, you know, Caged Heat, stuff like that, that it was, he was, had some interest in that. So I thought, okay, well, at least we'll have John writing the music. And at that point, he and Lou had fallen out. So this didn't help either. I think first I went to John to write the score, and I sort of assumed, oh, well, we'll use some Velvet songs. And I think it didn't help that he was writing the score. But also Lou Reed hated Valerie Solanas so much that they said no. So we got Yola Tango playing them for the whip dance and the party. But also at the very end, when we're playing out, we couldn't use Nico's version for some reason. I wanted to play out on Nico's I'll Keep It With Mine, which is a Bob Dylan song. So we were able to, I wanted to get Nico in there. But our budget was so tiny on that film. And originally, you know, I was very purist. I said, well, everything has to be authentically 60s. And Randy and I had an argument when we first met. Later we got on really well. But about, like, whether there could be cover versions. And eventually I sort of realized that if I wanted the music I wanted, we had to have some cover versions. And he put together a great group of Pavement, people like that, to do cover versions that sort of... But I think it feels pretty seamless. It feels, you know, Luna doing Season of the Witch. The Donovan song. It feels pretty seamless, I hope.
When we return, we'll talk with Mary about her experience making her most mainstream film, American Psycho. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions. Remember in 2018 when Border Patrol separated thousands of refugee kids from their parents, deported those parents back to their home countries, and kept the kids in the United States? Believe it or not, 6 years later, there are still hundreds of families who have not yet been reunited.
Though we as a community may feel hopeless at times, we recently learned about an organization called Al Otro Lado, which works to reunify families. They provide holistic legal and humanitarian support to refugees, deportees, and other migrants in the U.S. and Tijuana through a multidisciplinary, client-centered, harm reduction-based practice.
Since 2018, they've reunited over 100 refugee families ripped apart by the zero-tolerance policy of the previous administration. Once reunited, Al Otro Lado helps each family find legal representation, housing, and the counseling they need in order to heal and get back on their feet.
Imagine having your child ripped from your arms and never knowing when you would see them again. We can't let family separations go on. If you're like us and believe that all families belong together, then join us supporting Al Otro Lado and donate today.
You can find the link to donate to Al Otro Lado in the description of this episode, or go to gum.fm/charity and donate today. That's gum.fm/charity.
You can also consider volunteering with the organization, which offers opportunities that are both in person and virtual. The best way to get involved is by filling out an application on their website, elotrolado.org/volunteer.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
And we're back. This week, we're chatting with director Mary Harron about her expert use of music in films. Next, we dive into American Psycho and its chaotic production process. Let's jump back into the conversation.
What I want to ask you about is the iconic music scenes.
Where
we have Bateman waxing rhapsodic about Huey Lewis and the News. Yeah, right.
In 87, Huey released this. Four, their most accomplished album. I think their undisputed masterpiece is Hip to Be Square. A song so catchy, most people probably don't listen to the lyrics. But they should, because it's not just about the pleasures of conformity and the importance of trends. It's also a personal statement about the band itself. Hey, Paul!
And we have Phil Collins. You know, it's just perfect. And I know some of that was in the book, but you brought it to life.
When we started working on the screenplay, Gwyneford and I had this one idea. I remember summer afternoon where I had this idea because I'd been a music writer, and I always loved, I thought it was hilarious that in the book there are three chapters of kind of music criticism. They're really like parodies of self-important rock writing, kind of like a Rolling Stone essay. And yet they're dedicated to the blandest and most mainstream artists. You know, it's Phil Collins, it's Huey Lewis, it's Whitney Houston. And it's the only place in the book where Bateman writes about things with completely sincere passion. Because in this kind of fairly bland pop music, he sees his soul, or he sees himself, he finds meaning. And there's something very funny about that. And then I had this idea that what about, I'd love to use this, what about if you turn some of this into monologues? If he starts talking about music, sort of launches into one of these self-important monologues just before he kills somebody, then every time he starts talking about music, the audience is going to be on the edge of their seat because they think he's going to kill somebody. So, you know, the first time is with, he kills Jared Leto, you know, with talking about Huey Lewis. Then the next time it's the two prostitutes and he's talking about Phil Collins, which is actually one of my favorite scenes.
But I also think Phil Collins works best within the confines of the group than as a solo artist. And I stress the word artist. This is Susudio. A great, great song. A personal favorite.
And then they have a sort of sex scene where we to Phil Collins' Susudio, I think. And then, but he doesn't kill them. I think we didn't even try
couldn't
for Whitney
Houston.
Couldn't get
Whitney Houston, right? Yeah.
Yeah, we did. But I think that what we did was we found, I didn't realize that she hadn't written the song, that it was Dolly. And we found a sort of London Symphony Orchestra version that was fairly inexpensive because obviously money, we spent so much unholy amount of money getting Huey Lewis and Phil Collins rights. I think the music ended up costing maybe $750,000. Oh, you know, a huge amount of the budget went to the of a very low budget movie went to the music. They said, please find some others, find some alternatives. There must be, and it's like there is. We tried. There's nothing quite as perfect as what Bret Easton Ellis chose.
And obviously those were huge hits. Give insight, because I think a lot of our listeners are still kind of like trying to, don't fully understand the whole, you can't just pick a song and put it in a movie. You got to pay for it. And the question is the price, there is no set price. Oh, it's a Beatles song, it's going to cost you X amount. They can name whatever amount they want, right? I mean, there's no...
Or they can say no.
They can say no, but they can also put... It's $1 million. You want to play that song? And they just pick a number out of the air, right?
They can. And it's... In the old days when we started with I, Shiny Warhol, you would go to different companies. But by now, it feels like even the smallest label, the most obscure records, everything's owned by Warner Brothers in the end, you know, in the conglomerate. Yeah. But you're still...
Or Sony Music.
Or Sony. I mean, you're still doing deals, though. And when we did with Alice for School's Out, we went to him. And actually, originally, at one point, he was going to write a song for us. But we talked to him, and he was great. But he wanted... a version that he had done, like a more recent version. And I think that was also to do with his royalties. A lot of the time the artist will say, you can use the song, but you have to use this re-recording I've done. This happened with Charlie Says as well, with Blue Cheer. I want to use a couple of great songs from them. And so it's fine. I mean, in some ways you kind of, in an ideal world, you'd use the original recording because recording has changed and it will sound viscerally more authentic. But I think you just happy that the artist has let you use the song.
Well, I think it's more a matter of choosing the right songs. I think those sleights of hand. I don't think you shot in New York in the 70s or replicated any of the street scenes in Dali Land, but it works, Mary.
Yeah.
It's that punk rock thing. I got a roll of duct tape and some spit. I'm going to make this work.
Yes. And I think actually quite often, like the fact that in Dali Land we had to use some more obscure glam rock songs, I think, was an advantage, or disco. Yeah. But also in Charlie Says, this was also partly deliberate, but it worked to our advantage because we had a tiny music budget on Charlie Says. But I wanted to use the darker underside of psychedelia and not the very, I didn't want the Rolling Stones. But we do have the Grateful Dead, actually. There's one. I'm amazed that we were able to pay for that. It was almost everybody of the songs we used, like, had ended up being in, like Rocky Erickson or the 13th Floor Elevators. Yeah. Everybody whose music we used.
Arthur Lee of Love.
Yes. Always one of my favorite groups. And that album in particular, Forever Changes. Mm-hmm. To me, when I first heard that record, I thought about the Manson murders. Mm-hmm. Because it's a California record. An LA record, but it's sort of so sweet and beautiful and has an undercurrent of such sort of paranoia and dread.
And his lyrics are so sarcastic, yeah.
Yes.
At my house, I've got no shackles. You can come and look if you want to. Through the halls, you'll see the mantles where the light shines dim all around you. And the streets are paved with gold. And if someone asks you, you can call my name.
And it just feels like, oh, 60, you know, Altamont, you know, 60s going wrong, you know, the terrible things happening. Everybody, practically, whose music we used had ended up in a mental hospital. So it was Love, it was Rocky Erickson, and it was Skip Spence, you know?
Yeah. I wrote about Charlie Says for The New Yorker and compared the soundtrack in your film of the dark psychedelia. You know, there's two. You can go toward the white light on the psychedelic trip, or you can go into the abyss. Mm-hmm. You know, and then, you know, Quentin Tarantino in his fantasy, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, is using all this AM pop music, Paul Revere and the Raiders, right? Whereas, you know, Manson's music, he used his own music as well. You know, he had three tools, he told the early interviewers from Rolling Stone, the most complete interview he gave, Felton and Dalton, I believe. You know, he said, I had three tools. I had sex, I had psychedelic drugs, and I had music. Mm-hmm. And his ability to lure in and spur on to evil, you know, these young people who were normal people, and focusing on the women, you know, was just brilliant, because that question remains. It's unanswerable. But how do these, you know, bright young women fall in with this psychopathic con man? Sex, drugs, music.
Yes. Three tools. And also that I think it also becomes like, at the core, it's also like domestic abuse, you know, like how women in intimate relationships get involved in something that seems like love or seems, you know, idyllic, and then it turns into a nightmare, but they somehow can't leave, or their will or something, ability to make decisions is somehow eroded. I like cults, I think, generally are paradigms of domestic abuse.
For sure. And yet, you know, and then in Dali Land, these the singularly strange but also fruitful relationship between Dali and his muse and his wife. You know, I was thinking after Charlie Says, oh, yeah, this makes perfect sense. I could see how you were fascinated in that relationship.
Yes. And actually, I think we started working on Dali Land before Charlie Says. it was funny working on this with my husband because it's a portrait of a marriage, a very different marriage to ours. But
I met your husband. He did not see.
No,
it
seemed he's, like you have he's a healthier not. Relationship. He's not like that at all. But Gala is much sort of despised in a way. She's a kind of slightly demonic figure who dominated Delhi and was greedy. And in many ways, some of this is true. I mean, she was in some ways an awful person, but she was also kind of fantastic and a life force and a survivor and the person who propelled him to stardom. So we wanted to examine that marriage in all its complicated power dynamic, because in some ways she did everything for him, but she was also like his, she was his muse, but in some ways she was also his kind of servant. Like she would do everything, to, you know, pack all the suitcases, organize everything domestically. So she was both sort of master and servant in that. And it was a very complicated relationship.
Oh, to say the least, I had read a book, I'm forgetting the author and the title of the book, about famous muses in art.
Oh,
history.
Yes. And I have that.
And apparently Salvador was a coprophiliac. I was kind of glad that you didn't touch on that in the movie. We don't need it.
Yeah, I felt like, do we need that? I don't think so. Yeah, exactly. Also, I mean, this is also a thing about film. There are things that you can touch on in literature that are just too graphic or will dominate the narrative too much. We didn't even get into a lot of hardcore sex stuff with Dali. It didn't feel right in what we were doing because it was really this portrait of a marriage, and it was about the emotional interplay and the jealousies. You know, Dali's main relationships were platonic, you know, and he was a voyeur and all that, and fascinated by all kinds of perversions. But you know, there was also an aspect of a relationship where Gala was the mother figure and Amanda Lear was like the daughter figure. You know, there were these crazy warped families. But yeah, I think also, you know, as with American Psycho, some people were upset that we took out a lot of the hardcore violence. But if we hadn't, that's all people would have thought about.
Well, people always seem to be upset with you, Mary, because
true.
They expect you, they want you to give them one thing, and you refuse to make people one-dimensional. We had skipped over Betty Page, you know.
Oh,
Gretchen
yeah, Betty,
Moore's
yes, Betty.
Is, as you portray her, and as I've read about her, you know, she didn't think it was sexy at all. She was doing these pin-up poses, very cutting edge at the time. Wasn't sexy for her, it was a job.
When that film first came out, there was a lot of sort of annoyance and disappointment in it because I think people wanted a sexy film, a sexy sexual experience. And I was really interested in how the world looked to Betty. And for her, it's not like she didn't have a sex life, but for her, the experience of being photographed was the place, like Monroe, actually, Marilyn Monroe, it was the place where she was happiest. You know, it was the attention of the camera, the joy of just her in a room surrounded by a ring of flashbulbs and people, sort of love, the love of the camera, and her able to express herself. And that's a complicated thing. You know, she also had abuse in her early life, like Monroe. But to me, I wanted to express this, that she sort of took control of her life by becoming a photographic model. And another thing that people didn't understand was what was thought of as pornography then in terms of these photographs or films. There were no men in these pictures or photographs. So for her, she would have thought pornography or something sinful would have been involved having sex on camera, you know, or nudity. She was worried about nudity. But for her, you know, wearing a crazy outfit and traipsing around with a whip or whatever with some other women was just silly. It was play acting. And people were very offended that I had not done a more sort of searing portrait or of S&M. For her, it wasn't really S&M. She was not into S&M. Mm-hmm. So she didn't even... And the other thing I think people really have trouble understanding, you know, the past is another country. And how little people understood about that stuff in the 50s. The regular person wouldn't know what fetishism was or bondage. And she didn't until she kind of wandered into the Irving Claw Studios and was asked to put on some fetish boots. It's like, okay.
Yeah, well, there's multi-part Hollywood series, right?
Films, yeah.
I think what you're getting at too, Mary, is that there's cult of personalities that sort of develop around certain people. Like, you know, it was true of Warhol and Dolly, obviously. Betty Page. People have an impression of what that person is. Manson. And then I think your films sort of explore, like, okay, there's a human being under here. And there's certain the vulnerability, like of Dolly, like, you know, the one scene that always that stuck with me was Gala, you know, cracking open the egg for he was almost like a child, you know, in yes. front of her. Like, you know, he was just incredibly fragile and he needed Gala in his life. And, you know, it's interesting. Warhol, the same thing. Very, there was a vulnerability and a weakness is the wrong word, but they were fragile underneath all that.
Yes, I think so. Very similar. I think one of the things I always kind of come up against, this happened recently with Dolly Land as well, that people want an explanation when they go to what they think of as a sort of, you know, as a portrait of a famous person. They think they're going for answers about what makes them tick or, you know, and that's why there's a certain kind of Hollywood movie that presents some central traumatic event as, oh, well, that's the answer. Like, you know, your brother died when you were a child or, you know, you were sexually abused and that explains everything. But it's obviously very influential, these traumas. They don't explain everything about what you did. Both Valerie Solanas and Betty Page had early sexual abuse from their fathers. And Valerie Solanas became a radical feminist and, in the end, would-be assassin. And Betty Page became a world's most famous pinup, you know. Different paths. So, so the idea that, you know, and people felt with the Manson girls, well, you didn't go into their biographies to explain why they did what they did. And, you know, maybe we should have shown a bit more of their backgrounds, but the Manson girls came from all kinds of different backgrounds. And not one of their backgrounds really explained what happened. In a way, it was their normality. It was what happened once they got there. To me, the only person whose biography explained what they did is Charles Manson, who really did have a horrific light childhood and grew up in prison.
And accumulated all the skills to become an evil Svengali.
Yes, you know, and learn the kind of animal skills and the manipulation. Mm-hmm. But none of the Manson girls would have ended up as killers, I think. Their lives would have gone different ways if they hadn't met him. So what interested me is, what is the process by which someone gets drawn in and broken down?
It was certainly resonating with me in the midst of all that R. Kelly reporting when I saw Charlie Says, and then went back and read the book by the psychologist it was based on and revisited all the literature. It's a dark hole, that means. You got to make a cheerier movie next time, Mary.
Because I'm sure. Oh, boy. You must have really seen that in terms of how of the sort of horrifying sort of seduction and the way people are sort of demolished, really, their will and their self-respect and everything else.
Yeah, no, it's horrible. And there is no answer. It can't be just, you know, well, this happened, that happened. You know, it's a complicated stew.
I think that all we can understand, and you're seeing this actually, there's a documentary now about this cult at Sarah Lawrence where, you know, these highly educated young people were broken down and destroyed by this guy. And they're always kind of mediocre people in a way, people who have not made it in life.
Not extraordinary.
Yeah, no. All we can understand really is about the process by which this manipulation occurs and how people, you know, what the methods are of a kind of brainwashing. But I don't think that, you know, on the whole, it works on people from many, many different backgrounds and kind of characters.
You can see that with the Nexium story as well. People who you would never think would be sucked into this, sucked into a situation like Sarah Lawrence, like Nexium, like Kelly. Mm. You know, Mary, I wasn't going to ask you, but it seems unfair that everybody is compelled to bring up Ezra Miller as the young Dali. How are you handling that? I mean, to have this film that took years to develop, that is a brilliant film that involves 100 people collaborating, as all film does, right? Mm. You know, it's like, oh, Mary cast somebody who should be canceled. He's in a position of controversy now.
Well, it's so bizarre because, you know, the trouble that Ezra got in, which was really terrible watching this kind of massive breakdown happening in sort of slow motion over many weeks during which time caused a lot of damage. This happened, you know, many months after the film was locked and finished. But I think what happened was that they worked on Fantastic Beasts, and then they had a week off in between finishing Fantastic Beasts and starting The Flash, and they came and did Dolly Land and got on very well, was completely prepared, was all excited about it. And I think after The Flash, obviously there was things going on inside, but I think that suddenly having worked in this unbelievably pressurized, highly intensely scheduled world with enormous amount of pressure. And then you're very famous and you're young and there's no schedule. They got into a lot of trouble and then, you know, did damage to others. And I feel like Ezra's future could be a positive one because they're a brilliant actor, is they make amends to anyone they've hurt and they're in therapy now. And I think hopefully also in rehab, I think drugs and alcohol always play a big part in these things. I think that they both did damage, but it was, they were in, obviously in a, having a very serious and painful breakdown and needed help. I mean, needed to be in treatment.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And it happens in the full spotlight of the world media.
Terrifying. Yeah. And, you know, I'm not trying to dismiss anything that they might have done wrong at all. But I also think that they were very ill and are now getting treatment. People sort of jumped on me for saying, why didn't you cut them out of your movie? It's like, do people understand how movies are made? You know, for a small movie like mine, low budget, two things. One, we didn't have, you know, hundreds of thousands or $1 million to open up the movie, go back to all the locations, hire all the crew, you know, that just would be an impossibility. And we could not take those scenes out. I personally think that that is, with someone's work, that is the best part of them, you know. And real life crimes or misdemeanors should be dealt with in the real world, you know. Mm-hmm. So there should be real world consequences and real life amends made to anyone who has been hurt. But the fact that they've been in a movie before these things happened, really, I don't think figures. And my other feeling was, oh, you want me to take them out of my movie? Are you going to take them out of The Flash? Are you going to take them out of Fantastic Beasts or all the other movies they made? You know, what difference does it make to anyone, really? In you know, who does it help if I take Ezra Miller out of this film?
Well, it's something that definitely young art fans of the, you know, 18 to 20 that I'm teaching that are wrestling now. You know, I mean, Van Morrison says absurd conservative reactionary things now. Mm. And you know, do we not listen to the beauty of Astral Weeks? Mm-hmm. You know, John Lydon, you know, has been, and it's always hard to tell what he says for controversy and what he believes, but has seemed to have taken a turn toward the right. But does that offset him caring for his wife? Does that negate the brilliance of the Sex Pistols? You know, it's separating the art and the artist is a really tough question.
Yeah.
Yes, I mean, I don't know. I think if you really look back, you know, do we stop reading Dostoevsky because he was anti-Semitic? You know, do we stop reading Tolstoy because he was terrible to his wife? I mean, I personally feel like in many ways the best of people is in their work. And very often the worst is in their life. And I don't think that an artist should be given carte blanche to get away with anything just because they're a great artist, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think too often that has happened. Famous actors or Harvey Weinstein, you know, you don't get a pass for being talented. But I also don't think that if you have said or done things that means that invalidates your work. You know, it's complicated.
Yeah.
But I think that that's true. I wonder how all these arguments will play out. I also gathered that The Flash is a really great movie and they're probably going to make $1 billion off it, you know.
Avoid all those comic universes, DC, Marvel. Oh.
Exactly.
All right. Well, thank you, Mary. It's been an absolute pleasure. It was so great to meet you in New York, and congrats on Dolly Land.
Oh, thank you so much. And thank you. A privilege to be here. I appreciate it.
That concludes our chat with director Mary Harron, and now we want to hear from you. Give us a movie that you think uses music really well. Let us know your thoughts by leaving a voice message on soundopinions.org. Mr. Cott, what is on the show next week?
Jim, it's the end of the world, and I feel fine.
Yeah, we're doing okay.
we're doing songs about the apocalypse. There are many, many songs about the end of the world, and we're going to catalog a few of them. And don't forget to check out our bonus podcast feed wherever you get your podcast.
The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this program belong solely to Sound Opinions and not necessarily to Columbia College Chicago or our sponsors. Thanks, as always, to our Patreon supporters. Sound Opinions is produced by Andrew Gill, Alex Claiborne, and our associate producer, Sol Delgadillo. Our Columbia College intern is Lauren Holt, and our social media consultant is Katie Cott. Right, patriotic slam, fight, bright, my feeling.
the world.